Oh, good evening, everyone.
Good evening.
This is like the olden days. Just a few people around the campfire. Yeah. We used to always be so few, but Jaap went to Holland and for his brother's wedding, and Marie is in D.C., I think, and people are far, far away. But we're not. I've forgotten your name.
Rankit.
Let's do introductions around me. It's so small you might even remember somebody's name.
I'm Nico. Wendy. Leslie.
Rankit.
Judy.
Angie. So I apologize for not having been here last week. It was a debacle, but I couldn't do anything about it. And I'm very glad to be back. I brought an interesting thing that came over the internet from, I think it was Ed Brown who sent this. It's a possible Buddhist ceremony for the inauguration. And it's 3 pages long. It's quite remarkable. It's 4 pages long. Yep. So it starts out invoking the presence of all the Buddhas and homages to all the teachers, and then homage to everybody you can even imagine. It's a long, long list. And then praying for the well-being of our country and all its people and creatures. And then they made a list of principles in alignment with them. Through all the dimensions, no matter what situation we are in, we vow to support and call on these witnesses who hold this truth to be self-evident, that all people are created equal. And then it's a list: the U.S. Constitution, the Masons, the Bill of Rights, the Supreme Court, the Iroquois Federation, Congress, the Bible, Lady Liberty, the Office of the Presidency, the Liberty Bell, suffragettes, those who hold aloft a light in a time of human ignorance, the land of America, the beautiful, the people by the people, for the people, we shall overcome, Black Mesa, Source, and the bond of liberation. Black Mesa is, he notes, the Hopi sacred mountain, which they say is the center of America. Chanting then the Sai Shosai Myo Kichi Jo Dorani, Nomo Sanmo, etc., etc., and then dedicating the merit of this ceremony in our chanting permeate throughout space and time, holding our country, its peoples, and all beings in blessedness. All Buddhas, 10 directions, 3 times, all beings, Bodhisattva, Mahasattvas, wisdom beyond wisdom, Maha Prajna Paramita. So I'll leave it out if you all want to take a look at it.
So what did he call the list? Self-evident truths? Those are the self-evident truths on the list?
Witnesses.
Oh, witnesses. Okay.
Who hold this truth to be self-evident, that all people are created equal.
Okay.
So, one of my first thoughts about Buddhism when I first ran into it was, oh, it's just like we talk about democracy. We say the same thing. All beings are Buddha nature. We say all beings are equal. Sometimes they say equal in the eyes of God. So, sounds the same to me. It's a very high standard for the human animal. I think we have a hard time maintaining it, and every little bit helps. So we have ended part two. And the first sections of part three are just historical, really. It's written by somebody else, not by Huineng. And so it's just catching you up on what happened after. And then once they've done that, then different students are introduced and how they came into the fold of Huineng's practice. And they're very famous stories. They're all kind of enlightenment stories. So they're sort of essence of our practice on which our Soto Zen practice is based. So these stories will come up in everything else that you read, what Huineng said, including in Dogen. So this just says that he lived in Shaoshu for more than 40 years. And monks and nuns and lay people all practiced with him. 3,000 and 5,000 people, it says. It's a lot. He transmitted the Platform Sutra and used this as his testament. So unless a person has received the Platform Sutra, they have no authority. So this is all establishing the lineage. Really, basically. So the next section goes into the separation that developed as this school developed, the school of Huineng. He was ordained up in the north by the fifth patriarch and sent away to establish his own place. And the senior student at his teacher's place became the teacher there. That was the north. That was considered the northern part. And the southern part was Huineng. And they knew each other. They respected each other. They sent each other students. They would say to a student, oh, you should go on up north and check out the way they're teaching because it's pretty different and you might learn something, and vice versa. So it was all of a piece, but it was taken up as a political problem. And some called it the Northern and the Southern schools, and only the Southern school of Huineng was the real, true one. And so then they set up this controversy about it that has gone through centuries. When I first learned this, I was taught that it was a separation and that they never talked to each other and they were very mad at each other, and you know, it was a terrible kind of condition that they were in. It's not true. It's not true. They found these documents in the Dungwon Caves, and they found more since the first ones. And so they have more information now. And Red Pine has done a wonderful job of comparing different versions of the Dungwon and the different translations. And so I think the more we learn about it, the more we see that there really is no separation between them at all. So in number 39, it says, people all refer to the Huineng of the south and Shen Sui of the north, but they don't know the real reason for this. It's because Master Shen Sui served as abbot and practiced at the temple up in the north, and Master Huineng lived in Cao Zi Monastery, 35 li south of Shao Chu. There's only one school of Dharma, it says, but people are from the north or the south. This is why we use the terms northern and southern. And in the Sando Kai, the whole poem begins saying there is no northern or southern difference. So already he establishes it. And then he says, what is the origin of direct and indirect? One is supposed to be fast and the other is slow. Now, and I always like to remember Suzuki Roshi's answer to this when he was asked, was he enlightened? Was he enlightened fast or slow? This is the criteria. And he said, oh, it was fast, but it took a long time. Says it's people who are sharp or dull. That's why we have terms like direct and indirect or fast and slow. Some people just take a while and some people are there in a minute. And there's no accounting for it that anybody knows. And who knows how to even measure it? We can't evaluate it in any way. It doesn't really matter because we're all in the same soup together anyway. So practicing together is the essence of it. Buddha, Dharma, Sangha. Not some special exalted state. So then he has an encounter. Master Shen Sui often heard people say that Huineng's teaching was fast and pointed straight to the path. So Shen Sui told his disciple Chi Cheng, you're intelligent and perceptive. Go to Huineng's place on Cao Chi Mountain for me and pay your respects. But just listen, don't say I sent you. When you hear something important, make a note of it and come back and tell me. We'll see whose understanding is fast or slow, mine or Huineng's. So this is all apocryphal, of course, but it's pretty exciting. And come back right away, don't leave me hanging. So he sets up a spy thing. And Chi Chen gladly accepted the mission and left and reached the mountain and Master Huineng, and he paid his respects and just listened and didn't say anything but to say where he was from. But as soon as he heard the master teach, he understood and he grasped his original mind. He stood up and bowed and said, Master, your disciple has come from Yutron, not my temple, at Shen Shui's place, I didn't experience any realization. But as soon as I heard the master speak, I grasped my original mind. I hope the master will be compassionate enough to instruct me. And Wei Neng said, if that's where you're from, you must be a spy. And he said, I'm not a spy. Wei Neng said, why not? Ji Cheng said, before I spoke, I was. But now I've spoken, I'm not. The sixth patriarch said, it's the same with affliction is enlightenment. Same, same. So Red Pine says about this affliction is enlightenment that Wei Neng is quoting from what comes up in a lot of Mahayana texts. The mind that is afflicted and the mind that is enlightened are the same mind. Our original mind, the mind we can't leave, and the mind that can't leave us. As long as we are unaware of our real mind, we are afflicted. And as soon as we're aware of our real mind, we are enlightened and no longer afflicted. The mind doesn't change. The only thing that changes is our awareness of the true nature of our affliction, which is no different from the true nature of enlightenment. This statement also appears in another section, though here, well, this is more history. Cohen said the sixth patriarch was showing a deeper understanding. His way of practice was new. Pointing directly to the mind, the way Bodhidharma was doing it, and based on Bodhidharma's teaching, but even more so. He said he was not talking about Shen Shui, but rather the whole tradition. Shen Shui taught that discipline and precepts meant not to do any evil, wisdom to practice all good deeds, and calmness to purify one's own mind. These are the three principles of Buddhist practice. Thus, he was looking at the external and visible world, which is phenomenal and mundane, concerned with ethical stages of understanding. This implies that one who sits has a tainted mind. But the sixth patriarch was reviving Bodhidharma's teaching when he said, when the mind is free from evil, that is the discipline of one's own nature. If we think we are not perfect without discipline, we start looking for perfection, and so we sit. More important is to ask, what is the more complete way, turning our eyes inward? It says, life is peace, even when there is struggle and fighting. There's no person who doesn't struggle. It's expressed in Japanese as ivy vines, many views pulling you in different directions. But there is a difference between knowledge of the mountain and being at the mountain. When you're on the mountain and see the city lights below, when you're without food and shelter, city lights look wonderful. Even if you go to the mountain, there's a struggle. To actualize peace, you go alone. So what do you think, fast or slow? Pure or impure? Good or bad? What do we do with all of this? It's all
forget about it.
Forget about it. Too many words.
Too many words.
Yep. Yeah.
It's so simple, it's complex.
That's exactly right. Yeah.
If I remember correctly, Queen Ning and another guy were the two that wrote the poems about the mirror mouth.
Yes.
And it certainly seems like the guy from the north is continuing his train of practice exactly like the poem.
That's right.
Whereas Queen Ning is also doing the same thing.
Yes.
Yeah. So this encounter with Queen Ning in that koan, while it opened him up a little, didn't change his practice. He stuck to his original thoughts.
I mean, Shen Sui.
Yeah, Shen Sui.
Yeah. So, no, he continued to teach that.
Right.
Which also is deeply Dharma as well.
Yeah.
So...
He's the fast, slow one, and the other guy's the slow, fast one.
Yeah.
Yeah, you got it.
Well, that's how they did it. You know, they didn't have anything else to do, so they sort of...
So where did Rinzai come from then?
He was not involved in this. He didn't come until much, much later.
Yeah.
He was from Dogen's time. Hundreds of years later. Mm-hmm. So by that time, it was all fast, sort of, for Rinzai, and slow for Soto.
Right, right.
And you see it in their practice. They walk real fast and, you know, do their interviews, bam, 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 like that. It's just really amazing. And we're kind of slow. Quiet, very, very quiet. And the best is that we're talking to each other. The two so-called two sides. That there are always at least two sides to things. And if you take it as being attached to your own side, then you miss out on a whole lot of truth that's happening over here. And our brain doesn't work to meld them. We cannot meld the opposites. Our brain doesn't like it. We want to have one side. We want to hate the other side sometimes. But it's kind of a poisonous aspect of the way our mind works. And practice helps us to see that, of course, there are always two sides. It makes things harder. We have to work harder at it to see through our own inability to try to accept that there are two sides. And then we have to choose. That's even harder because we do have to choose the place that's most fulfilling for ourself and our world as we view it. So it's really all up to our own view, our own mind. Which is what the Declaration of Independence is saying and all those other things. You know, it's all up to you guys. Let's do this together.
Someone that I'm very close to is very engaged in, what's it called now? Communication across religions.
Ecumenical?
Interfaith, thank you.
Interfaith.
And she says it's because, for her, all religions are the same. And I have such a strong reaction to that because, well, I mean, of course, there are threads of shared values across many religions, and particularly probably at the sources of how the religions are practiced now. But for me, it really comes down to the theistic and non-theistic religions. And when I hear you say there's always two sides, or it brings that up for me again, and the choosing, and so I've chosen what resonates for me, which mm-hmm. is a non-theistic path. And I can also accept that that everyone has a path, and that my path isn't for everyone. In trying to live a good life in mm-hmm. a conventional world, you know, at that level of things.
But she's putting everybody under one roof.
Yeah.
That we're all practicing the same thing together.
Yeah.
Yeah.
You know, the golden rule and love and kindness.
Well, they do run through just about everything you can imagine, because how else could we possibly live with each other if we didn't have those things? But that isn't the same as religion. No, but Zen isn't really religion anyway. Zen is a practice, which Koban always said you can make a religion out of it and just add on all the things that a religion would be. And people have done that. And they made it into Pure Land. Then they made it into Zen, Rinzai Zen, Soto, all these different ways of based on meditation itself.
And certainly the way it's practiced in the family temples and that sort of thing.
Yes.
In Japan.
Yeah.
I mean, it's more like a religion.
Oh, it's totally a religion.
Yeah.
Yeah, and it's being revived in China. But Buddha was a religious practicer also, and they call that Hinduism. So, you know, we think, oh, he's a Buddhist, but he didn't think he was a Buddhist any more than Jesus thought he was a Jew. He was a Christian, he was a Jew. Mm-hmm. So we just take these fragile little thoughts that are flying around and ideas and try to paste it all together into a story that doesn't really add up. And it's kind of noble to think of us all under one roof. But if we want to know for ourselves, we have to choose and really dedicate ourselves to our practice. and embrace them, mm-hmm. everybody, without, you know, saying my way is the better way, because it is for you, but who knows? Mm-hmm. Coben always said 50%, he always believed 50% God, 50% not God. So he put himself in the middle of not knowing. And where else to be with these sides that we keep coming up with, but just stay in the middle and hold it all together. Hold it in our mind. It's big enough to hold. We're big enough to hold it. Yeah. Oh, you just... it's 8 o'clock. Anything we have to know about?
No. I don't have any announcements.
Karen has set everything up.
Yeah. Schedule, people know. So we have a new opener on board.
Super.
Mostly got trained tonight.
Super. Thank you, Nico.
This was Nico's first time.
I will give you a key so you can
tonight. Yeah.
Okay. I'll be safer that way.
Yeah.
Thank you. That's fine.
Okay. Do our 1 minute sit.
Thank you.